Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Got a great show lined up for you today and tomorrow. Tomorrow's show, we're going to talk with Preston Dennett, True Accounts of Contact with Extraterrestrials. We'll discuss his book, Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. He's been collecting stories and researching this and has some fascinating tales to tell. That's tomorrow. Plus, we have a brand new theater of the mind that you want to catch tomorrow as well. Tonight, we're going to talk with our guest, Stephen Music. And he has written a book, a true story, Life After Heaven, How My Time in Heaven Can Transform Your Life on Earth. Fascinating book and a fascinating account. Stephen Music is the founder and CEO of Destiny Capital, a respected financial advisory firm, holder of 3 master's degrees in management, financial services, and international economics. Music has taught at the University of Denver, Daniels College of Business. His goal is to spend the rest of his life helping others experience God's love and the kingdom of heaven here and now. He's been interviewed by numerous media outlets, including our good friends over at Coast to Coast AM. He's here with us this evening to discuss his experiences. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a delight.
I'm always intrigued by these stories and these aspects, as many of our listeners are, and how these moments impact everybody individually. Before we get into what happened to you, can you take me back to your life, Stephen, many years before any of this ever occurred? What was your life like? Were you a religious man? Were you intrigued by the strange and anomalous? What can you tell me about yourself at a younger age?
Well, I was, as a little boy, I was one of a family of 4, and I was raised in a Christian home. My surroundings at home, so I knew about Christianity, I knew about God, and I knew about Jesus, and I knew about heaven, and, you know, we were Orthodox Episcopalians, which is sort of a redundant term, I've been told. but essentially, we were well steeped in Christian tradition, and so it was pretty much taught to me as an academic exercise of faith. And you know, church was something that you did; it was a ritual. And so that's where I got my roots, my spiritual roots, from such a young age.
And to you, the whole concept of religion and spiritual roots, did it resonate with you? Did it just feel like you were going along following a ritual, as many people feel when they, you know, are first indoctrinated into religions, that it's kind of like they're just following a certain line of rituals, you know, the way religion is usually taught? Or did you feel a deeper spiritual connection?
I really did not feel a deep spiritual connection as a young adult and someone in adolescence. It was one of those, it was very much like going to school. You know, you went to school, right, and you studied and you took tests and you got grades, and there was a sense of almost academia to it. And so I wouldn't say that anything was for me dramatically deep or spiritual in nature. I didn't really understand that you can have a relationship with the risen Christ. I mean, that really wasn't part of my religious upbringing. It wasn't part of the experience.
Well, you open your book sharing this very unique dream. Can you share that dream with us and why it became so significant for you?
Yeah. I'm sitting at an intersection. This dream occurred in 2011. I'm sitting at a large intersection really close to our home, and I'm at a red light, and a white moving van pulls up on my left, and a white panel truck pulls up on my right. So I'm sitting there in a canyon of white. Both trucks are huge. I drive a little blue Subaru station wagon. And the light turns green, and neither truck moved. And I got impatient, and I put my foot to the accelerator, entered the intersection just in time to get hit right at the driver's side door by a green and white trash truck traveling at a terrific rate of speed running the red light. It literally cuts my car in half. I'm a chalk outline in the middle of the intersection. I am gone. I'm dead. And then I woke up. I had been dreaming.
Well, that was cheery, huh?
Oh, man. It was one of those dreams where you were there. Mm-hmm. I mean, Steven Spielberg and Walt Disney and Lucasfilms couldn't have done a better job of putting me in that place. I was, you know, literally there.
Right.
And when I woke up, I also experienced what I've come to understand is a bubble of the kingdom of heaven in our bedchamber. And it was powerful enough, it was present enough, that it woke my wife up. And
it was a shared experience. It wasn't something that we could just say, well, maybe Stephen was just kind of dreaming this. This actually occurred, and there's a second witness to this.
And that's kind of what made it really dramatic. One, it was dramatic in that I drive a blue Subaru station wagon. It was also dramatic because I recognized the intersection. I mean, I drive through that intersection on my way to work and on my way home virtually every day. And so I told Elaine, recognized, oh my gosh, something really important just happened. What is going on? And I told her what I just told you. And she was not happy. she was like, this is really weird. And so we prayed. And we're trying to understand, having a dramatic dream like that, there must be some reason for it. And so we prayed, and nothing happened. And we didn't get revelation. No one spoke to us, you know. And so we went back to sleep. Well, at least one of us went back to sleep. It took me a while for the adrenaline to bleed off.
Sure.
But the next morning we prayed. And we literally were on our knees for 3 weeks trying to understand what in the world all of that meant. And we finally gave up, and we got all the way to gallows humor. You know, Elaine was going, now wait a minute. We had Mexican food that night. She said, that's it. I've got a solution to this.
Right.
And so after another week of being in the land of bland, you know,
right.
I find myself on a Thursday afternoon in my little blue Subaru station wagon, this time for real. This is about 5 weeks after my dream. And I'm sitting at that intersection at a red light. And a white moving van pulls up on my left.
Oh, no.
And a white panel truck pulls up on my right. And it's deja vu all over again. It's an exact replica of the start of my dream. And literally, the red light turns to green, and I don't move. And an eternity goes by. I mean, it was up to 4 seconds. And then a green and white trash truck rockets through the intersection.
Wow.
You see, both of those truck drivers, from their elevation, they could see him coming.
Right.
And they knew he's going to run the red light, and he's not stopping. I mean, he's barreling for all he's worth. Well, I couldn't see any of that being in the canyon of white. After the trash truck went through, the trucks put their vehicles in gear and went through the intersection, and I followed. And I didn't get very far. I'm about a block or two, and I have to pull over because I'm now just nauseous, and I got goosebumps. And I'm in a parking lot, and I hear two things deep in my soul. The first thing was, I could bring you back to heaven anytime. And the second thing was, I want you to get serious about telling your story.
Wow.
And so out of that was a was a very strong call, what I felt like was a call from God, that said, talk about what's been happening to you over your adult lifetime. And so the best way that I knew to do that was to begin to tell my story to, you know, family and friends and people close to me. And ultimately they encouraged me. They said, you know, this is a great story. You ought to write a book about it. And so Life After Heaven is now on shelves. It's in every major airport in America. It's in every distribution outlet you can imagine. And the book has sort of taken on a life of its own, because the story of the book is that heaven, the kingdom of heaven, is closer than we think.
Well, if I can stop you for 1 second, Stephen.
Yep.
The story you just told with the dream and then seeing it occur raised the hair on my arms. And let me explain to you real quickly why. It was 1990. My grandfather had passed away. I had gone through a really rough time of trying to deal with that, and I had a lucid dream with my grandfather in it. I had a dream visitation where he came to talk to me about death and life, and he ended it with, stop worrying so much about death. It's far for you. So very far for you. And that was basically how the dream ended, after we said goodbye. Well,
what a gift.
Right, it was. Well, here's where it gets really strange, and especially because of the story you just told, Stephen. So a few days later, I'm living in Illinois. I'm driving on the road, Meacham Road, I believe it was. My girlfriend's in the car next to me. I own at the time a Geo Metro, which is an aluminum can on wheels.
Yeah, really?
It's raining out, and I'd looked down for a second. When I looked up, I realized that the trucks in front of me had stopped, and I slammed on the brakes and just began to slide. And this is a little car, and we're coming into the back of these trucks flying. And I remember I turned to my girlfriend at the time, and I said, oh, God, I'm so sorry. And I let go of the wheel, and I just put my hands up on my face. And, Stephen, this car, which was right down the middle of the road, right coming into the back of this truck, this car swerves by itself, goes between the two trucks, stops at the light, the car engine cuts. Boom, that's it. On the right side of me is a white truck. On the left side of me is a white truck.
Ooh.
And there's no lane between us. Stephen, this wasn't a three lane street. This was a two-laner. But my little Geo Metro slid right between these two vehicles. If you could roll down the windows, you could reach out and touch both trucks on both sides of my car. That's
Holy
how close we were. And both of the drivers looked down at me like, oh, my God, are you alive? What just happened? They took off and did their thing, but all I could hear at that moment was my grandfather saying, stop worrying. It's a long way away.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that was a dramatic way to make your point, Grandpa. Let's not do this again. But what was locked in my memory was they were these two white, nondescript trucks, big semi-trucks. There was no markings that I remember on them.
Wow.
Just two big white trucks that surrounded me, just like yours. And just like yours, I slid to the intersection and didn't go through. And had I gone through, I would have been hit.
Yeah.
Had I tried to keep control of the wheel, I probably would have hit the back of the truck. I just gave up and let God take over. And that wheel, I still, it just astounds me to this day that happened. But that you were between two white vehicles, two white trucks, and I was, that's just a weird, uncanny experience.
Well, you know, it wasn't your time.
God, I hope not. I'll keep buying that chip as long as I can. Well, now talk to me about this. I mean, let's go to your story with this. It was, you had joined the Navy. Walk me through what happened that started this aspect of your life in motion.
Yeah, military personnel in North Chicago, where I was stationed, were used as a test bed for the swine flu vaccine in 1976. And, you know, military personnel, they line you up and you get inoculated. You don't have any choice in the matter. And I had an allergic reaction to the swine flu vaccine, me and a whole bunch of other people. And so I'm at Great Lakes Hospital, and I've got an IV in my arm, and a nurse comes in and she says, "This will fix you right up." And she's got a full syringe loaded with what was the antidote to the swine flu vaccine. And she inserts it, the needle into the IV tube and pushes the plunger all the way in. And they didn't know, and neither did I, that I'm allergic to aminophilin. And so I'm dealing with the swine flu vaccine, and they just injected me with a lethal dose of a serum that I'm violently allergic to.
Oh, no.
And I'm in the emergency department of Great Lakes Regional Hospital, and I go out. And I was out for 5 weeks. I woke up.
Now, when you say out, you went into a coma? Out.
Gone. I was done.
Okay.
And I did, as a military person, I don't have access to my medical records.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that I woke up 5 weeks later in intensive care isolation, and there was a Navy nurse at the foot of my bed charting. You know, she's making recordings and all of that. She was a little startled that I woke up to begin with, and she got up and looked over at me, and she said, "Welcome back. We thought we lost you back there." And I had realized that, oh my gosh, I'm back in Chicago and I'm in a hospital setting somewhere, because during that 5 week period of time, I died, I went to heaven, and I had the most wonderful experience of being with the risen Christ and building a relationship with Christ in heaven for that entire time. And I remember that was 41 years ago. I remember that now, right now, today, like it happened last week.
Well, talk me through the moment of you get this injection. Are you conscious of the fact that you're dying at this point?
Yeah, I realized something was seriously wrong with me because my right arm got enormously hot. And the heat got all the way to my armpit, and then I'm blacked out. I have no idea.
Now, you black out. Consciousness is gone. How do you reawaken?
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean
I'm
in
gone.
The hospital. Right. How is it that you reawaken, and
no,
not in the hospital, not physical form, but what happens to you then?
Well, it's a very common experience for people that have had near-death experience. You're weightless. You're literally transported. You go through a tunnel of light. You know, you feel like you're watching a science fiction, you know, something on warp drive or transwarp speed or hyperspace if you're a Star Wars person. And then you get pushed out at the other side, on the other side, and heaven is a real place. It's a real place. It's real gravity. You actually have a form. You have a body there. It's my body. And my experience was being inside the most incredible, vibrant place in life. It's like being inside pure joy. And I met the person of Christ.
But when you're there, are you conscious of the fact, oh, I'm dead?
Oh, yeah.
My physical form is gone. I'm on to somewhere else. Okay. So you are conscious of that. It's not like you just kind of wake up and you're like, oh, here I am at home. I mean, this isn't like a a place that you expected to be. This wasn't something along those lines. This was a very conscious understanding that you were separated, that you were no longer alive.
That's exactly right. And you sort of intuitively, you know it's heaven. You just know it's heaven. And I figured while I'm there having conversation with Christ, I think I'm staying. I mean, I think this is life as it's supposed to be, and I'm liking this. I mean, this is a whole lot better than the place I was. And
now, was there so physical sensation? Could you feel the breeze on your face? Could you feel the sunlight? Was there a sensation to this moment?
Yes. Yeah, that's
what
part of the
like?
Fact that it's a real place.
Right.
You know, the sunshine is bright and warm. The clouds are cumulus and wonderful. You know, the sky is blue. My experience of heaven was all outdoors. So I'm sort of in an agrarian, you know, there's wheat fields on my right. There's rolling meadows on my left. You know, there's mountains in the background. It's a wonderful place that you would want to go and visit and never want to come back from.
And while you were there, when you kind of came to this consciousness that you were dead, you just had this knowing that you were in heaven.
Yeah.
Did you see animals? Could you hear birds? Did you see other people milling about? Was it the flowing white robes, or were you in an AC/DC t-shirt and shorts? I mean, what what was it like? What was that whole tactile experience?
My experience was, I had a form. I was in body. I was in my body. I did not see any other people there. That's sort of unique in my experience of near-death experiences. The only people that I saw there were Jesus, and you clearly, you could hear the birds. They're actually part of the music and the song that is resonating in heaven. I did not see any other animals, but most of my experience was conversation with Christ and literally in the time it would take you to walk through a couple of acres of very ripe wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation with Christ was about me, was about my life, the way my life had unfolded up to that point in time.
Well, I don't mean to keep going back to the whole experience, but again, you're getting an opportunity and a window into something that many of us will not have until it's our time, and we won't get that chance to come back and revisit or relive that. When you meet Jesus, you meet the risen Christ, what does he appear as? Does he look like the, you know, white Anglo-Saxon version we have of him with long hair and blue eyes and pale skin, or is he a different look, or is it a just a bright light that you just get a sense this is Jesus? What can you tell us about the actual meeting and confrontation?
Well, Jesus himself is a person.
Right.
And he's 5'11", long flowing hair, hazel eyes, dark complexion. He's
so
gentle.
He looks Middle Eastern in
oh, yeah.
Look, he does not look like all of the contemporary versions of the whited out version of Jesus we see in paintings, right?
Right.
Okay, great. Well, that's important to me too, because knowing that you kind of came into this with a preconceived notion, because you already had this religious upbringing, it's fascinating to me that when you're confronted with Jesus, he didn't look like the expectation of what Jesus would appear to be.
No, but at the same time, you know, he grabbed me by the shoulders, said, "Welcome," and embraced me the way my father always did as a kid, a deep, what we called army hugs back in those days. He was just happy to see me. And so he's strong and powerful, at the same time, he's soft and soft-spoken and gentle. He's a paradox.
And this discussion that you're having with him, are you asking him, you know, where's everybody else? Where's my family? Where are you getting that? Or is Jesus just kind of riffing and talking to you and, you know, filling you with knowledge?
Essentially, that time period was conversation about me and talking about and helping me understand what occurred in my life and how my life had played out up to that point in time. I was raised in a Christian home, but nonetheless, my experience growing up was violent, and I was pretty much vacant. You know, I had no identity personally at all, and I was a victim of very strong physical abuse from my brother, who was bipolar, undiagnosed bipolar. And so I was a mess. I mean, I'm 20 years old. I'm in the United States Navy, and I'm a mess. And the conversation that I had with Christ explained all of that to me and made it okay, made it less of a mess.
All right. Well, see, that's fascinating to me then. I mean, here you're dealing with this mess of a life. What does he say to you that gives you peace about what you experienced? Why, you know, did you say, why did I have to live through this pain? Why did I have to deal with this abuse?
Yeah, and those were some of my questions. And the answer to that was, A, Jesus was there. He was there when all of that stuff was going on. And it was purposeful. There was reason for the way that my life had played out up until that point in time. And that was acceptable to me. It was like, okay, yeah. And you got to remember, when I'm having this conversation with him, I'm thinking this is like the introduction to heaven, and I'm going to spend the rest of my life there. And so I was just happy with the dialogue. I was really enjoying the idea that, oh, okay, you know, I'm 20 years old. Okay, that works for me. And
now, was there ever a pull towards the living? Did you think, I'm going to miss my dad, I'm going to miss my mom, I'm going to miss my girl or my friend? Did that ever come to mind? There was no sense of remorse or loss?
Not at all.
Okay.
There is such joy in heaven that you really don't think about who you leave behind. And I didn't give a nanosecond of thought to, you know, what my life was like prior. I was just really happy to be in that place, having that kind of conversation with the risen Christ.
Well, you say that you told us this experience in heaven. It was very vivid.
Oh, yeah.
You've had lingering spiritual and obviously emotional effects from your time there.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an explanation, maybe one or two of the ways that your life and faith were influenced by that moment and that time in heaven? And were you aware of the concept of time when you were there? Did you realize how long that you were visiting?
Let me answer the last question first. There is no such construct of time in heaven. Doesn't exist. Time is only a construct here. So the five-week coma that I was in at 20 years old felt like an afternoon in heaven. I mean, they don't relate. They don't equate. They're not the same. And so time has virtually no meaning there. The first question that you asked had to do with about my experience of Christ and how that affects my life now. Because Jesus was very intentional about telling me that he was with me even during the beatings, even during the periods of time where I felt so alone and vacant and lousy, that's also true in the here and now that I live in today, that I'm not alone, and that there's a connection that says I'm closer than you think. Don't ever forget that. And after 41 years now, I never have.
All right, let's do this. We're up against a break. I don't want to dig too deeply into that. Let's come back and find out what it was like for you after this visitation to heaven. What is it like to believe you've finally gotten home? You're no longer in pain. You're no longer dealing with the disappointments that life had handed to you. And now you're home. You're at your just rewards.
Yep.
But that slips away. We'll talk about that with our guest, Stephen Music. When we return, you're listening to Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is Beyond the Darkness. Remember, you can hear us here 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. You can tune in and find a brand new episode as we explore all the strange and interesting world around us. Today, our tale takes us to heaven and back. Stephen Music, our guest, he is the author of Life After Heaven, How My Time in Heaven Can Transform Your Life on Earth. It's a true story of a man's supernatural encounter with heaven, Jesus, and how it turned his life upside down. He's here with us this evening. Stephen, you take this journey to heaven, a place where, let's face it, we all want to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And you're there with God, with Christ. You're having this conversation. Does the concept of hell ever come up? Is there ever any penance? Does he talk to you about, you know, there is some retribution that needs to be done for things that you've done on earth? Is there any of that talk at all during this conversation?
No. Again, I was just really thrilled to be where I was.
Sure.
We didn't spend any time talking about the nether regions.
Okay. Well, I didn't know if there was, especially knowing that you were going to have to come back. You didn't at the time. I didn't know if there was a warning, you know, from heaven that, hey, you know, this is where you belong, but you have to, you know, walk the walk, talk the talk, and this is your place. There was none of that. It was just acceptance, love, and y'all come back now.
Yeah, and welcome. You know, this is where you were ultimately destined. This is where you were supposed to be. Good for, you know, that was my experience.
All right. How does this moment end? And again, you said to you it was an afternoon in heaven.
Yep.
In reality, it was how long? 5 weeks?
5 weeks.
So when it's time to say goodbye, what does Christ tell you? Does he tell you it's time to go back now? Does he point off in the distance and go, hey, look, and then you turn around and he's gone and you're back in your body? How does this happen?
This was really, really important. We were sitting underneath a gigantic oak tree having conversation. He's got his arm over my shoulder. And as lovingly as he could, he looked at me, he turned and looked at me, and he said, and you can't stay. And with those words, I woke up in intensive care isolation. Blink. I mean, it happened as fast as what I just told you.
It so was he didn't give you time to pitch your case for staying. He just said, oh, by the way, you later, and you were gone.
Yeah, I'm back in the tunnel of light. I'm rocketing back into the land of reality, and I wake up in intensive care isolation in a dark room and in an excruciating pain.
And when you wake back up and you are conscious of what you just went through, does it seem like a dream at that moment that you just experienced, or do you feel that you were really there, that you were physically in heaven?
I feel like I was physically there. It was as real. And again, after 41 years, it's as real today as it was back then. And that tells me that it wasn't a hallucination. It wasn't, you know, something that I just conjured up. It wasn't aminophilin. It was real. It was an event that happened to me.
You make it to a place where, again, we all want to go. And now, not only are you thrown back to face life here, it's with a whole lot of pain and a whole lot of suffering.
Oh, yeah.
What is it like to return from heaven, Stephen? What's that like psychologically, emotionally, and physically for you?
The stark contrast between here and now and being in heaven is so drastic that it leaves almost everybody that's had that experience in a state of disillusionment, because you really don't want to be here. And I was in a place where I returned to a fractured body, and I was in a place, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is a mess. And you enjoy being in heaven so much that living in here, in the here and now, is such an altered state. You're thinking, I don't really, if I have a choice here, I don't want to play this hand. I got twos and sevens.
Right.
I got the worst hand there is in poker. Come on, give me a break. And I returned to give you some background here. When I was in boot camp, I qualified to go to SEALs. So I was 5'11", I was 195 pounds, and I was chiseled. And when I woke up in intensive care isolation, I was 126 pounds. And I'd lost more than half of my lung capacity. I was having a really hard time. There was an elephant sitting on my chest.
Wow.
And all of that, and I was literally bruised from head to toe. And the bruises were painful. It was like somebody took a baseball bat and just beat the crap out of me. And part of that was I had all kinds of blood clots in my extremities.
Because of being laying there for 5 weeks?
Yeah, and part of what happened to me was I had extraordinarily high blood pressure for a very long time. And it was so high that that my blood literally exited through the capillaries in my central circulation system, and that's what created the bruises. How in the world I didn't have a cranial bleed or a heart attack that killed me is actually part of the story. That's part of God's sovereignty, and that's kind of why the Navy nurse was sitting there going, we thought we lost you back there, dude. We figured you were dead. And you read it through my personnel records, and you get a real good idea the Navy never thought I was going to wake up. Huh. They just thought, well, he's in a coma, but it ain't long before, you know, something else happens here and he's done. So it was real surprising to them that I actually woke up.
Sure. Now, before you were sent back, you know, before he said, oh, by the way, you can't stay, boom, you're awake. Were you tasked with anything? Did he tell you, I need you to go back? I need you to tell people about this? I need you to do this? What was it? No. What was that like?
No, I got no marching orders.
Really?
It was just, you can't stay. And he was sad about that, but it's part of God's sovereignty and the way that my life has played out over these years. You know, there was a reason that I was not allowed to stay in heaven.
Did you have to face, I would guess it had to be a pretty deep form of depression.
Yeah.
To come back and have to deal with what you were dealing with.
Yes. Yeah. And I was disabled. I was discharged as a disabled veteran. They gave me a disability pension and a severance package, and I was very, very significantly compromised for about a decade, almost 10 years.
And that in itself is torture, that you had to deal with that. When you're back, are you mad? Are you questioning God? Why did you send me back here? Why am I here? What is this about?
Yep. The first 10 years of my life, from age 20 to age 30, was for me back to an academic exercise of reading the Bible and trying to understand, A, what happened to me, and B, what does it mean, and why wasn't I allowed to stay in heaven, and what does all this mean? And it was a period of time in my life where I was sort of wandering in the wilderness. I was trying to figure out my life and what the world am I supposed to do now. And it was a constant battle to deal with the medications that I was on and the health and vocation, because I couldn't get a job. Nobody would hire a disabled veteran that was, so presented in such a compromised state. And I was also in a place of, I loved being in heaven so much, and I'm back here, and what am I supposed to do with this? How do I integrate that into my life? And the only thing that I knew from my upbringing was, Orthodox Episcopalian, go read the Bible and learn about what I'm trying to read. I'm trying to understand the kingdom of heaven from an academic perspective again.
And what did you find when you looked at that? I mean, there's an interesting kind of dichotomy, right? You can go read about it, but that's all kind of conjecture and hearsay. Now you can actually go in and say, it is like this, or it is nothing like this. What is that like for you? I mean, what was that rationale like?
Well, it was sort of academia and education from a totally different perspective, which is I'm reading the Bible from a place of experience, not questioning. Because I already know that what I experienced was real, and it's my ultimate destination, and I'm trying to find pieces of my experience in the Bible, in the Word of God. And
Did you ever hit levels of despair where depression and suicide crossed your mind so that you could get back there quicker?
Yes. Yeah, that's clearly part of that experience.
How would you talk yourself out of that?
I had a general sense that if I took my own life and changed the timetable and the sovereignty of God such that I would go back to heaven ahead of schedule, that I'd be received in heaven just like I was before, mm-hmm. Welcome. And there would also be a second emotion, a second piece to that, which is, really? I mean, it's like, well, welcome back, but really? You're here way ahead of schedule. And there's a sense of disappointing the Father, and that if I've learned anything in my entire life, it's that the sovereignty of God is powerful, and that He's God and I'm not, and my job is to follow His leading here. And it never got to the place where, suicide seemed like a really good idea, but I never
acted upon it.
Yeah, I was never, I was never to that point. And I was also married to an angel of a woman, and she made life in the here and now certainly worth living. And I would not do that to her.
Do you ever worry that by sharing that aspect that you feel like if you had taken your life, you would have been accepted? Are you afraid that that might paint the wrong image to people that are on that dark bridge right now? that may be enough that they think, well, you know what? Yeah, they may say, may look at me and say, really? But at least I don't have to put up with the pain here anymore. What, you know, do you have any fear of that kind of flashback for this kind of experience?
I would say, and I would encourage people that are in that kind of a position now that are listening and might be connected to someone that is in that place, the sovereignty of God over our lives here means that there's something really, really redeeming and good still planned. Don't miss that.
Did you talk to people? I'm sorry, go ahead.
There's a reason we're all still here, and we have work to do here. Find out what that is and get to it. Because the depression that you feel, the darkness that you feel is the adversary. It's the enemy. The other side of that is the kingdom and the Father. Find that. Pursue that.
Did you tell people about your death, about your experience in heaven and your return to earth right after you dealt with that? Or did you keep that to yourself?
I pretty much kept it to myself for two reasons. One is I didn't really fully understand what just happened to me, and I didn't really understand why in the world I'm still here. And until I had some answers to that, I wasn't going to talk about that. The second thing was I'm an introvert by style and by personality profile, and it was excruciatingly difficult for me to talk about it. And I didn't want people to ask me questions that I didn't have the answer to. I mean, I'm still trying to figure this out as a young man between 20 and 30 years old. I mean, I didn't even tell my wife until age 30.
And what was that like? I mean, how do you begin that conversation with somebody about something so deeply personal?
Yeah. Well, she had lived with me through 10 years of disability, and she's a medical professional herself, and she was instrumental in my care. But I was getting sick one period of time, and I went to one of those healing services at a Vineyard church where we were attending, and they laid hands on me in a classic charismatic Christian experience, and God gave me my health back. And it's as dramatic as anything that I can imagine, because they laid hands on me and I was sick. And I woke up 20 minutes later, and it's the first time in 10 years that I could take in a full lung, full inspiration of air. And I drove home that night, and I told Elaine the whole story. Chapter and verse, the entire thing. We were up all night talking.
How did she respond to that?
She was overjoyed that she got her husband back and that I was now a father that could play with my kids. And she knew that something was not exactly right with me, but she attributed that to, you know, aminophilin and being on so much medication that, of course, no one could really be right with all of that. I did the best I could do. But we, our life became joyful in the way newlyweds are joyful even after then 10 years of marriage. It was a gift. It was a pure gift from the Father, because as a part of my healing, I went back to heaven. I went back to the exact same spot that I was in and talked to the same Jesus that I talked to 10 years earlier, only this time he had totally different conversation with me. And when I came back and he said, things will be different from now on. And oh my gosh, was that true? Because my whole life is different.
Most people would sit back and be in honesty, and I believe you believe this too, right? Most people would sit back and go, why was there another 10 years of hell for me? What was the purpose of that aspect? Why not, if I'm going to come back and I've got this this thing that I'm supposed to do, why did it have to be so painful?
In my mind, everybody goes through trials. Everybody goes through periods of time in their life and events in their life that are challenging and fashioning and, the refiner's fire. And it makes us better. It makes us tools. It makes us exactly who it is that we were supposed to be. Do I like the process? Not particularly, but you know what? I love the results, because the results are in a place that now I live my life for my family. I live it for Elaine. I live it for my boys. And I also live it for the people that I'm around, because I'm about experiencing the kingdom of heaven here on earth, because I know that there have been countless times over my life that I've had events with people here that felt very much like being in heaven. And if I had to sacrifice 10 years of my life in order to bring that to people, it was worth it.
But knowing, that's what always amazes me about these kind of situations, because I've heard from many people that have had your kind of awakening, that there was this long path afterwards. And man, 10 years is a long time to have lost, Stephen. 10 years was a long time to be miserable and unhappy. There's no resentment at all that was it? Because I think that's what most people have a hard time wrapping their head around, right? Is I lost 10 years. I could have, this is just not a way to live.
And I guess I'm in a place where I could focus on the period of time that was challenging and that was lost. But I frankly focused on the fact that for the first time in my adult life, I have complete health and I have complete vitality. And I was just overjoyed to be restored to my family, to be able to play with my kids, and to continue to be in a place where I can experience the kingdom of heaven in the here and now. And one of the reasons I'm still here, one of the reasons I'm alive, is that I have context that almost no one else does, in that I know what heaven is like. I carry that with me every day. And I continue to experience and anticipate the kingdom of heaven in my midst every day as well. I look for it. I anticipate it. And the really amazing part about that is that I'm experiencing the kingdom of heaven almost every week now. Because I think we're supposed to.
Why do you think God allowed you to have this experience? Why of all the people on planet Earth, Stephen Music, why were you chosen for this?
That's something that's up to the sovereignty of God, and he decides how people's lives play out. I think the reason that he chose me was that at this stage, and I'm 61 years old now, I'm a mystery. I'm an introvert by style, and yet I'm a teacher. And I'm a business owner because no one would hire me, and it turns out that I'm a serial entrepreneur. And it's put me in a place where I have great relationships with a lot of people at a very deep level. And that the Father has made me and given me a message that is beginning to resonate with a whole bunch of people about, life here is not what it is supposed to be, and we can change it. and we should.
Well, let's get into that in a few moments. Talk to me about your doctors had told you this was an irreversible issue.
Oh, yeah.
And suddenly, Stephen, you're healed. What was the medical community? How did they deal with this?
Dr. Jenkins looked at me over his glasses and he said, you've had another delusional episode, you know. and he did that until he took out his stethoscope and put it on my chest. And then he's the one that's having hyperventilating because he said, this is not your chest. This is not what we've been dealing with for the last 10 years. Something dramatic has happened to you. And I told him the story. And he went, we're going to start taking you off all your medication, and we're going to do it gradually. It took about a month, because all of the meds that I was on, you don't stop cold turkey, it'll mess your system up.
Right.
But he said, frankly, you don't need any of this, you don't need any of this, because my blood pressure was normal, my inspiration was normal, all of that stuff. And the miracles of the kingdom of heaven occur in the here and now. And I'm proof of that. And it was a free gift. It wasn't anything I had to earn. It just happened.
Well, now you've experienced many of these kind of holy moments. You were just talking about these moments of heaven. Bubbles of heaven, I think you called them in the first segment, where you feel this presence. Can you describe one of those for us? I mean, what is that like? Is it a euphoria? Is it what does that moment feel like when you're in it?
One of the things that's unique about the bubbles of the kingdom of heaven in the here and now is that they are clearly places, and there's geography to that. And they ignite, they expand, and then they don't last. They pop, and the encounter, the period of time is over. And they are like being in the midst of joy, because almost every one of them, the people end up with either weeping or hugs, or a resonant deep in their soul that says, man, this was good stuff. And that's exactly the response that we have when God intersects our human lives in the here and now.
You say that it's closer. Heaven is closer than we think.
Yep.
What does that mean? I mean, what is your definition of that?
I believe that we're suffering, our culture currently is suffering from 100 generations of experiential drift. And that is, the first generation Christians 2,000 years ago had a continuing experience with Jesus here on earth, and then with the disciples and the apostles in the first generation. And that all of a sudden after that, we've been drifting ever since to the place where we don't experience the kingdom now. We experience it academically. We experience it in a faith way, but we don't experience it practically. And we should. And so my work is that the kingdom of heaven is closer than we think, and we can experience it over and over and over again. We just have to anticipate and look for it.
All right. Well, walk us through that. Give me some tips. We've got listeners that need a little bit of heaven right here, right now. Mm-hmm. Right? Like the old Christmas song, we need a little Christmas right this very moment. There's a lot of us that need a little taste of heaven. What can we do right now to experience that joy, experience that peace?
Some of that is recognizing that what I just said is true, and the understanding that it can happen. It's possible. The other side is there's two elements to it. There's somebody here on this side that is an agent that is involved in this kind of activity, is a volunteer that says, hey, I'll take you there. Because bubbles of the kingdom of heaven often occur within community. They often occur within a group of people. And then you volunteer for the process. So, for example, one of the worship leaders in our church he's a young man. I mean, he's like 17, 18. He just left for college. And I had a sense that this young man was a Levite. And Levites were very, very sacred minstrels of the gospel. And this guy was a talented musician. And I happened to be wearing an oversized sweater, even for me. And after the service, I took my sweater off and I handed it to him. And I said, here, this is a shroud. This is a garment. Wear this because you're a Levite. And I told him what the Levitical priesthood was all about. Well, a 17-year-old becomes a puddle on the stage of the church that we attend, because he knew that he knew that he knew in his soul that he was a musician and a minstrel and he's a worship guy. But no one had ever told him that. No one had ever actually stood up next to him, hugged him, and said, hey, here's what I'm seeing. And then we had a wonderful conversation about welcome to heaven. This is a kingdom, is a bubble of the kingdom of heaven. And now he's off to college, but, you know, he's going to learn a whole bunch of stuff, but he'll carry that experience with him for the rest of his life. That's experiencing the kingdom of heaven in the here and now. And I think we could be having more and more and more of those kinds of experiences all the time. We just don't anticipate them here. We've been drifting for so long, we've forgotten the first love, which is the presence of the Spirit of God in the here and now.
Now, you say something in your book that I find intriguing, and I want to hear more about this. You say in your book that your purpose, the reason that you're still on earth, is to make my death worth living for. Now, as somebody who has had a lifelong, terrifying, paralyzing fear of death, what do you mean by that?
One of the uniquenesses of almost everybody that's had a near-death experience, gone to heaven and hasn't been allowed to stay, is collectively as a group, we don't fear death at all. That is not one of our driving paradigms for us at all. It doesn't occupy any of our souls. And frankly, for people that are worried about death, for people that fear death, I would say rechannel your fear, because you're worried about something that absolutely you don't have any control over. And focus on where are you going when you're done with your sack of skin. And I know when I'm done with this sack of skin, I'm going back to heaven. I have no doubt about that. And for people that have a working, living relationship with Christ, you know where you're going. And for me, I don't focus so much on where I'm going when I'm dead. I focus on what can I bring to people that are in the here and now and living. Because I'm interested in a more vibrant culture and a more vibrant community here. Because I think that's why Christ came. I think that's why he's in heaven. And the kingdom is expanding here on earth perpetually, and we can participate in that work.
What's the one thing that you hope you leave your readers with with your book, Life After Heaven? What do you hope they really take from this or get from it?
There's two things. One is that they can do a pass and review, an instant replay of their life, and go back to periods of time where you felt an unusual touch from God, and think about that moment and whether or not that was a bubble of the kingdom of heaven. Lots and lots and lots of people have communicated with me in all kinds of different ways that, yeah, you know, I think that was a bubble of heaven and I never knew it. I never realized that. And the second thing is that I think that that guy who lives in Denver, Colorado, I think he's right. His words and his story resonates with me. And I'm going to say go with that, because that means you're on the journey toward experiencing the kingdom of heaven now, in the here and now. And that once you do, life forever, life changes. Life is forever different when you do. Because there is a certain yearn for that that says, oh, that was really good. I'd like to do that again. And there's a living God on the other side of that equation that says, okay, there's more. There's always more. There's more opportunity. There's more of me than you know. And I'm closer than you think.
Well, Stephen, I can't thank you enough for sharing your journey and your story with us. And I hope that our listeners will find answers in your book and that they can reach out. Again, Life After Heaven, How My Time in Heaven Can Transform Your Life on Earth. This is a man who, by all accounts, had the favors stacked against him and left him in a broken, miserable place. So for many of you that are out there feeling bad for yourself because you didn't have something go your way, remember this guy was a young, strapping, healthy man that was about to enter the Navy SEALs. And one instance changed that life and forever marked him. But he wasn't defined by that marking. He didn't allow that to cripple him. He became an entrepreneur, a serial entrepreneur. He pushed himself when nobody else would believe in him. He continued to do so. And that's also an amazing and important part of your story. And I hope our listeners hear it, because I know there's a lot of sorrow and darkness in the world, and I know there's a lot of fear, and I know there's an easy want and desire to give in to that sadness and let your life be robbed from you.
Yeah.
I applaud you, Stephen, for doing what you're doing and for stepping out and making a life out of what most people would have, you know, been destined to live in a wheelchair and live a miserable existence the rest of their life. You took and turned it on its ear, and that wasn't good enough for you. You then wanted to share the story so maybe others can have that same happen for them. So thank you for doing that, Stephen.
It's been my pleasure, and it's my calling. Experiencing the kingdom of heaven in the here and now is a great reward for me in and of itself.
Well, have a great night. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow night, everybody, Preston Dennett will be here with us discussing his book, Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. We'll do that here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Thank you.